This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today is Dr. Bill Hine, who's retired professor of history from South Carolina State University. Bill has just completed a history of South Carolina State entitled South Carolina State University, a Black Land-Grant College in Jim Crow America. Bill, welcome to the Journal.
Thank you for inviting me, Walter.
Let's just sort of explore the title a little bit. I bet not many folks understand that State was founded as a land-grant college.
Well, it was in 1896 established as a separate institution. But prior to that, beginning in 1872, there was an A&M Institute established by the General Assembly and attached to Claflin. It was a very peculiar arrangement that prevailed for the next quarter century or so. And by legislation that passed in 1896, the A&M Institute associated with Claflin was separated and an autonomous institution was established next door to Claflin in Orangeburg on land that Claflin had had, but it was then conveyed to the new institution, which was established as the Colored Normal Industrial, Agricultural, and Mechanical College of South Carolina.
So it was an A&M.
It absolutely was, under the terms of the 1862 and then the 1890 Morrill Acts.
South Carolina State was birthed as a result of the Tilghman political revolution in South Carolina in the 1890s and the desire to create a segregated society through the 1895 Constitution. I guess a lot of people don't understand Tilghman's role in creating South Carolina State.
Well, he played a pivotal role in the creation and establishment and the first few years that the institution struggled to get on its feet. If it hadn't been for Tilghman and the ability of then former Congressman Thomas E. Miller to work with Tilghman, and it was a very, very peculiar political relationship that existed between the two of them, the institution would not have been created. So Tilghman was essential to the creation of Clemson and South Carolina State and Winthrop, for that matter.
At the same time, threatening to close down the Citadel and the South Carolina College or University of South Carolina.
Oh, he would have been delighted if South Carolina College, now USC, and the Citadel would have crumbled and disappeared.
He viewed those two institutions as bulwarks of his enemies. The Citadel and USC, they were the old Hampton conservatives who were bitter enemies of Ben Tilghman. And he threatened to close them down, but he never did, which I've often found interesting.
No, he would have liked to have. Additionally, he thought that it was just a waste of taxpayers' money, and it was a waste, frankly, of students' time to attend an institution in Columbia that taught literature and history and foreign languages and economics, or to have a military school in Charleston. This was just a flagrant waste of taxpayers' money when young people, especially young men, and as far as he was concerned, young white men, could get a practical education that would be useful to them personally and useful to the state's economy.
And the same with Winthrop for young women, basically to train them as teachers and homemakers.
That's right.
But in terms of the Jim Crow world that he helped create in South Carolina, the impetus for what would become South Carolina State was to make sure that there would be no black students at Clemson.
None at Clemson, none at South Carolina College, none at Winthrop, and certainly none at the Citadel.
He didn't push for the creation of State out of any goodwill towards the state's black majority. I mean, Thomas Miller working with him is one of those strange relationships, because in the Constitutional Convention, Miller was very vocal and very effective, if you read the minutes, in defending black voting rights, black education, but then we have him working with Tillman to create a segregated college.
Yes, and it could have been created conceivably with white faculty. But Miller especially was determined in the separation of the A&M Institute from Claflin that white faculty, who then had been and continued to teach at Claflin, a Methodist institution, would not be at the new Colored Normal Industrial Agricultural Mechanical College of South Carolina. And Tillman backed him up on that.
And in fact, that policy of hiring only African-American faculty continued well into the 20th century, did it not?
It continued until the 1964 Civil Rights Act. As far as South Carolina State was concerned, they hired no Asian or Caucasian faculty members, nor did they admit any as students until after 1964.
But now the Board of Trustees was a whole different matter.
The Board of Trustees was, as Tillman insisted and as Miller accepted, all white and all male until 1966, 70 years exactly.
Here we have Thomas E. Miller, a man who was prominent in South Carolina politics from Beaufort. He becomes the first president of the Colored Normal, and I'm just going to call it state. I'm just going to call it State College, because even before it was officially named that, it was referred to by most, particularly African Americans, as State College.
Yes, nobody ever called it the Colored Normal Industrial Agricultural Mechanical College of South Carolina. They had no T-shirts or sweatshirts that said that. But it was on every diploma until 1954. And many people, Judge Perry told me one time, he would not display his undergraduate diploma from South Carolina State because it had that very unwieldy and demeaning title.
Well, let's just kind of explicate that title, because that tells us in many ways what was taught at State for well over a half century. All right. Normal, to prepare, teachers.
Correct.
Agricultural.
Absolutely. Mechanical.
Mechanical.
Industrial.
Industrial.
College of South Carolina.
Yeah. It wasn't to teach people to be, mechanical was not to train engineers, it was to train craftsmen. We're looking at a school that certainly in its early years more reflects the Booker T. Washington model at Tuskegee, do we not?
Oh, yes. It followed in that model and the model that had been established at Hampton, where Booker T. Washington had attended in his youth. So there was this emphasis on agricultural and mechanical training that prevailed, at least initially, at Clemson as well, emphasize agricultural training so that farmers, be they black at South Carolina State or white at Clemson, would have access to knowledge about soil, soil productivity, fertilizers, insect eradication, animal husbandry, so that they would be more productive farmers. And initially, that's what the emphasis was in terms of agricultural training at Tuskegee, at Clemson, but at the other early A&M schools that were established by the Morrell Act in the late 19th century, be they black or white institutions.
Today, we would think of them or what used to be the tech schools train people in basic skills, whether it's working on an assembly line or mechanic or what have you.
Right.
Now, for State, that came in handy because, yes, the college was created, but the General Assembly didn't appropriate. You've got to have some buildings. You've got to have faculty. The State was pretty stingy when it came to funding this college that Ben Tillman had helped create.
The stinginess continued and continued and continued. And as a consequence of that, the students built the institution. I mean, students taking masonry, carpentry, built the initial buildings, Morrell Hall, Bradham Hall. That continued to be the case until the 1920s and even the 1930s during the Great Depression. Student labor was used to some extent, a lesser extent than it had been previously, in the construction of new facilities on the campus.
Now, was State co-ed from the beginning?
Yes.
All right, that makes it unusual in itself.
Yes, because none of the other schools in the state, the predominantly white institution, the absolutely white institutions. Clemson was a male school and with strong emphasis on military training up until the 1950s and 60s, much the way Texas A&M is to this day. Of course, the Citadel was military training as well, and it was confined to males. Winthrop was confined to white females. South Carolina College here in Columbia had female students, but not very many.
You've mentioned the military now. Under the Land-Grant Act, did not there have to be military training?
Military training was required at the A&M institutions, and it was very problematic at South Carolina State because they could not get any assistance from the then War Department. They would not provide any military officers to provide that training. So SC State undertook its own efforts to train young men in terms of some military background, some military skills.
Well, part of that state could only have black faculty, so there were not very many black officers there. They had to take care of it themselves.
There were no black officers available, and until they did get an ROTC detachment established just after World War II, there never were any black officers assigned to South Carolina State, much to the chagrin of the earlier presidents.
When we talk about co-education, we talk about military and student labor. Female students took what we'd, I guess, to say home economics, but there were military uniforms required, including the women had to have a uniform, but they were made there at the college.
Right, tailoring. And so the uniforms were made for young men and for young women. I mean, it was pretty much a self-sufficient enterprise. Had they not made the uniforms, had they not participated in the construction of the campus facilities, had they not maintained the farm, the crops, and the animals.
Okay, I was going to mention that because they didn't have a huge amount of land, but obviously it was very productive. They produced most of the food consumed on campus and then some for sale as well, right?
Right. There was some income for the institution produced by the farm, and then some of the products raised on the farm went to the dining hall, milk, for example.
Let's talk about how State was organized in those days, and quite frankly, it wasn't a whole lot different from many private schools because in addition to having a college, you had a elementary or prep school, high school attached to it as well, right?
Yes. In fact, that was the main thrust of the institution for its first two and a half decades. It was essentially an elementary school and high school. In the early 1900s, the second decade of the 20th century, and it wasn't until about the middle of the 1920s that they began to make a transition away from primary and secondary education to offering collegiate education to a large number of students. And then in the Great Depression, the high school shut down.
The idea of having junior high or high school or prep schools attached to colleges was not peculiar to SC State. Private colleges, for example, for women, Limestone or Wofford for men, they had a prep school because the schools of South Carolina, no matter whether they were for black or white, were not turning out individuals ready to go on. In fact, I was really amazed at the story of Benjamin Mays when he came to South Carolina State, and you might want to tell that story about how he tested. He was ready to go to college, but they wouldn't let him.
Yes, he had come from Greenwood County by about 1910, 1911. He was 16, going on 17 years old, and decided he wanted to continue his education, unlike his older brothers and sisters who had to continue to do farm labor. And he arrives in Orangeburg and believes he's going to have the opportunity to attend a collegiate institution. And in fact, he was attending a college, but he wasn't enrolled in the college. He took some entrance exams and was placed in the eighth grade at that time and spent three more years there and finally finished. But when he completed his time at South Carolina State, he completed essentially high school and then went on to college. He spent a year in Virginia and then went to Bates College in Maine and received a bachelor's degree at Bates College. So his experience at South Carolina State, which he cherished, was as a high school student.
His story, and you've got a very nice description of it, one of the difficulties that administering South Carolina State in terms of the faculty is that students came and went. May said every February he had to go back to Greenwood County to help get the fields ready for the spring planting.
He did. And finally, he told his father, who insisted that he return, that he was not going to come home. He was going to complete that term at South Carolina State. And he feared that his father would send the sheriff for him. It's in Born to Rebel, his wonderful, wonderful autobiography. And fortunately, his father did not dispatch law enforcement to come and drag young Benjamin E. Mays out of a class at South Carolina State and back to the farm in Epworth, South Carolina.
But his story was not unique. This was common with many of the students there at the college, right? They came and went in terms of helping back home.
It's curious today to see the emphasis at colleges and universities on retention of students. There was no retention of students at South Carolina State to speak of. Students did come and go. They would come and spend a few weeks, leave, come back, spend some more time, maybe return the next year, maybe not. They very often did not get either a diploma from the high school and certainly not a degree from the collegiate program such as it existed in the early 20th century. So if they measured retention rates at South Carolina State and many other schools, black and white, they would have been very low indeed.
The degree that they would have gotten in the early 20th century was a licentia, right, of some kind?
A licentia of instruction.
Yeah, which meant that they would be eligible to teach in the black schools of South Carolina.
Right. And the white schools offered the LI as well, the licentiate of instruction. It was sort of a glorified high school diploma. You went for a couple of years or so beyond your high school education, such as it may have been, and then you were entitled to teach in the public schools of South Carolina. And that prevailed into the 1920s and a bit beyond with some of the older teachers who continued to work in the public schools.
When did State finally begin to become a college, emerging from this first 25 or 30 years?
Well, ironically, as the Great Depression begins to take hold in South Carolina in the 1920s, by the latter part of that decade and then certainly into the 1930s, it became a college, as we understand it today, emphasizing a four-year degree. The high school closed, thanks in large part to the Depression, in 1933. And the young students, like Mays had been a couple of decades earlier, were no longer on the campus. Students who were as young as 14, 15 had come in from out of town, and even younger students who attended the elementary school from Orangeburg and the surrounding area.
There were dorms. The students were housed on campus, right?
Yes. From the beginning, they stayed in Bradham Hall, Morrell Hall, Lohman Hall. After both Bradham and Morrell Hall burned down in 1916, they built two new dormitories, Manning Hall and Bradham Hall, a third Bradham Hall for women, and Lohman Hall was constructed at that time. That was for young men. Three dormitories.
And those first dormitories that the students had built were all wood.
The Morrell Hall and the first Bradham Hall were frame construction. Some of the timber came from the campus.
The campus had a sawmill.
Yes. They actually created a sawmill. It was a used sawmill. They bought the equipment for it, used, and proceeded to take timber from both on the campus and elsewhere to construct these very early buildings.
This move to college status, a good bit of that has to do with the leadership of the college. The president, Miller, ran afoul of State politics, Cole Blees in particular.
Yes.
And he was replaced by
Robert Shaw Wilkinson, who was already on the faculty. And he is named president by the trustees in 1911, and he will remain president until he dies at the age of 67 in 1932. And so he does oversee this transition from essentially a primary and secondary school to a full-fledged college.
Well, you're very frank in discussing how the Board of Trustees look at hiring the president. They want somebody who is, quote, safe, particularly on the racial issue?
Oh, yes. That continued until Maceo Nance was appointed president in 1967. The previous five presidents would not have lasted. They wouldn't have been appointed in the first place had there been any question as to their commitment to Jim Crow society.
You address this issue, frankly, in your book, but what else could these men have done? Their goal was to try to create as strong an educational institution as possible, given a Jim Crow world.
They had no choice but to accept that. Not only would they have been in jeopardy of losing their job, the whole institution might have been closed had there been some sort of protest or uprising or criticism of the prevailing racial arrangements that existed well into the 20th century.
Well, you give Wilkinson credit for really moving the institution forward. You weren't too happy with his dealing with the political situation, his currying a favor, particularly with Coley Blease.
Well, Blease was the governor when Wilkinson was appointed president following Thomas Miller's removal in 1911. And Blease was even less enchanted with black education than Benjamin Tillman had been. He was absolutely no friend of African Americans, and Wilkinson would not have been appointed if there was any hint that he did not accept Jim Crow and segregation and disfranchisement that existed at that time. But Wilkinson continued to attempt to work with Blease through the 20s and wanted the help of Blease after he had finally been elected to the Senate to have him, Wilkinson, appointed to a commission on Haiti. It didn't happen. It was embarrassing. It was humiliating, and it didn't win Wilkinson any accolades from African Americans who knew about it.
Well, what about the gifts he would make to politicians?
Well, the institution, both with Wilkinson and perhaps Miller before that, I'm not certain about that because some of those early records have been lost, but with Robert Shaw Wilkinson and then his successor, Miller Whitaker, they were pretty much compelled to provide gifts, if that's the right word, to trustees and to politicians. So the tailor shop under Professor Waterman made suits and shirts for trustees, for governors, lieutenant governors. The women in home economics made cakes and assorted delicacies for guests, for politicians, for trustees and their families. They even provided animals from the farm and sometimes equipment from the farm for trustees. It was not a situation that would bear up under any ethics investigation today, that's for sure.
Bill, we need to pause for a moment, let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Dr. Bill Hine about his newly released book, A History of South Carolina State University. All right, Bill, I'm just thinking of the pressure that these leaders were put under, the trustees, the governor frequently, I don't want to say messed with, but
Interfered
with faculty hiring, you name it. It was just almost an impossible situation, and you also have difficulties. The president of South Carolina State, particularly Wilkinson, considered himself to be the spokesman of African Americans in South Carolina. Well, that didn't go down with people like the Reverend Mr. Carroll or others. There was infighting.
Oh, there was constant infighting and politicking on the campus and among African Americans off the campus. Now, I don't want to leave anyone with the impression that Wilkinson was so conservative that he was simply a tool or puppet of white politicians, including Coleman Blease. Clearly, he was not. That would be a false representation of Robert Shaw Wilkinson and his wife, Marion Birney. Robert Shaw Wilkinson, like those early presidents, was a race man. He's very proud of who he was. He was proud of his people. He worked for them. He cooperated with them. He tried to advance them. One of the striking things to me on the campus for its entire history from 1896 was the strong emphasis on African-American heritage, African-American culture, how African-Americans in previous generations had confronted the problems of slavery, the problems of race, and worked to overcome those problems. And people like Thomas Miller and Robert Shaw Wilkinson and Miller F. Whitaker absolutely stressed the importance of African-Americans knowing their past and identifying with people who had contributed to their advancement as a race.
And in the 1920s, there were required courses in Negro history as it was.
Beginning in World War I, Asa Gordon began to teach a course in the history of the Negro, and that continued. And very early on, they were celebrating Negro History Week, as it was then known, what is now African American History Month. February was devoted to African American history beginning in the 1920s. There were programs, there were concerts aplenty. It went on well beyond a week.
And the college observed, I thought, significant holiday. Emancipation Day was observed. Frederick Douglass Day was observed.
Yes.
And prominent alumni like Benjamin May seemed to be really devoted to the school once he became one of the most prominent African-American educators in the United States. Mays came back every year to Orangeburg to speak on campus.
He came back every Easter to deliver an Easter sermon at the invitation of the YMCA and the YWCA, which were very prominent student organizations in the first half of the 20th century. And people looked forward to hearing Benny Mays come to the Whitehall Auditorium and deliver this Easter sermon or address that began, my memory's not real specific, but about 1940 and continued to the late 1960s. 67, I believe, was the last year that he delivered an Easter sermon.
Well, before we leave Dr. Wilkinson, we've got to make some mention of his wife, Marion Birney Wilkinson, who was a real leader in the African-American community despite the double whammy of being a person of color and a woman. She had incredible leadership skills.
And she far outlived her husband. He had died in March of 1932, and she lives and stays directly connected to the campus until her death in 1956, and she was active in Orangeburg. She was active around the state and nation. African Americans knew Marion Birney Wilkinson, Mother Wilkinson, to generations of students very, very well.
And she was a leader in the Colored Women's Club movement in the state.
Oh, yes. And she worked with a home for young black women who'd run afoul of the law. The state did not provide any facility for the so-called juvenile delinquents, and Marion Birney Wilkinson was a key figure in establishing Fairhold north of Columbia in the 1920s.
And then was later named in her honor.
Yes. The original Fairhold burned down. They reopened another facility in Casey, and it was named after Mrs. Wilkinson.
The impact of the Great Depression on our state, I mean, everybody knows that South Carolina was already about as low on the totem pole as you could be economically. The collapse of textiles, the drought, the boll weevil, all of those, the exodus from South Carolina, both black and white, in the 1920s. How did South Carolina State, it seems to me in reading your book, not only did they survive, but somehow during the Depression, they seemed to actually move ahead.
By the late 30s, that would be true. For a time, the survival of the institution, I think, was definitely in question. Robert Shaw Wilkinson had died in 32, a new president came in, Miller F. Whitaker, an architect by training, but he taught on the campus for many, many years, and the economy collapses, and the survival of SC State is in doubt. But by the late 30s, First, there were New Deal programs. And second, they finally began to get substantial help from major philanthropic organizations. By then, the Julius Rosenwald Fund, and Rosenwald was a key figure in the founding and the expansion of Sears and Roebuck. And then with the General Education Board, the GEB, which was funded by John D. Rockefeller. And that brought money onto the campus for facilities and programs that helped it begin to get back on its feet by the late 1930s. And along with some of these New Deal programs, the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, the Public Works Administration, the National Youth Administration, they got out of the Depression and then on into the 40s and World War II.
The impact of World War II, particularly of returning veterans, those returning veterans like Matthew Perry and others weren't going to accept a Jim Crow world. They wanted to go to law school, for example. So our General Assembly solution was?
To create a law school, because no black South Carolinians were admitted to the University of South Carolina Law School. And by terms of a Supreme Court decision in the late 30s in Missouri, a separate law school was established in Missouri for black people who wanted to attend law school in that state. And in 1947, thanks to a lawsuit brought by an SC State graduate, John Wrighton, a separate law school was established following a court decision at South Carolina State that year, and it would last for nearly two decades.
Until desegregation. And desegregation had an impact beyond, I mean, the law school closes because students can come to the University of South Carolina Law School. But one of the main community outreach efforts that state had had for years was the extension program. And there was a separate black extension program operated out of
South Carolina State, parallel to the extension program out of Clemson. The money came from the state and the federal government under the terms of the Smith-Lever Act back in 1914 to create these cooperative extension programs, but the money was funneled from Clemson down to South Carolina State, and they established a separate extension program for home demonstration agents and for farm agents, and they spread out throughout much, but not all of South Carolina to provide rural families with knowledge and skills and information to help them cope with their lives and to sustain themselves as farmers and agricultural people. And it was a separate program until the late 60s. And then with the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the extension program was absorbed into the Clemson extension program, and South Carolina lost this key element in its public service responsibilities that had gone on for decades.
Before we went on the air, you and I were talking about the double-edged sword of desegregation. Here you have a program that rural African Americans in South Carolina identified with at State College, and then it's no longer State College's program. It's the South Carolina program, and it's managed out of Clemson. The impact on student enrollment in the 1960s and 70s. So let's segue a little bit into this, as you do in your last few chapters, the impact of desegregation beginning in the 1960s on what is primarily an African-American institution.
Well, you're right. A double-edged sword is a good way to describe what happens. It happened with the extension program, and these black extension agents in these rural and very isolated counties in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and end of the 1950s, Williamsburg and Hampton and Allendale and these kinds of counties, the extension agent was literally a lifeline to many rural black families, although there weren't enough agents by any means to go around and to reach out to the large rural population. But you had the extension program. Then you had the creation of the law school in 1947 and enabled young black men and a few women to attend law school. And they graduate and turn around by the 1960s. And the law school graduates are beginning to hammer away through court cases. People like Ernest Finney and Matthew Perry and John Wright and others to bring down the edifice of segregation. So that even though the law school does not last, it was never well financed, and it never was accredited, it had a lasting impact on South Carolina. The college ran all kinds of programs for black high school students in the 30s and 40s. They had science fairs. They had math competitions. They had debate tournaments. Students were music coming to the campus constantly from the black high schools in the state. And with the end of segregation, that dissipates and disappears. The athletic program had been, of course, confined to African Americans, and they graduated some exemplary athletes, men and women, into the 1960s, and it tended to flow on into the 70s and 80s. So when the end of legalized segregation comes, much of what the college had done and been responsible for and reached out into the black community begins to decline, and finally it no longer exists. There's certainly no extension program. There's an extension program from South Carolina State. I should not say that. They revived it in the 1980s, with cooperation with Clemson. So now there are some extension people. The law school is gone. The campaign to work with public black high schools and their teachers has gone by the board pretty much as well.
Because there are no more officially black high schools.
No. I mean, there are some that are, of course, predominantly black. But by law, the system of public education is an integrated system now.
When did State College officially abandon its program of hiring only black faculty and staff?
That was under President Turner in the mid-1960s, in the aftermath of the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He had tried earlier on. The problem that South Carolina State faced in being required by law to hire only Negro faculty and administrators and admit only Negro students was that they could not get access to enough black faculty members who had doctorates, because there weren't enough black people with doctorates. It was a very difficult proposition for a black person to get a doctorate in any discipline in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. It was impossible in the South, and it was almost impossible at many northern institutions. So there are only a handful of black faculty members available, and people who were on these accrediting committees, especially SACS, the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools, wanted faculty with doctorates. Well, SC State did not have faculty with doctorates, and they could not hire them until, at least in very large numbers, until after the passage of the 64 Civil Rights Act.
You note that particularly dealing with President Turner, who was pretty authoritarian, that he might hire a promising black faculty member who's soon going to go off somewhere else.
Right. They received much higher compensation at other black institutions. So they flee for Tuskegee or Grambling or Fisk or Atlanta University or Howard and leave Turner behind, having lost another faculty member with a doctorate. And they didn't have very many in the first place. They did not have a faculty member with a doctorate until the late 1940s. I mean, they went through 50 years, and there was not a person on the faculty or staff who had a doctorate.
The administration of Dr. Turner is a milestone. It really marks the end of an earlier era. I looked at some of the regulations. You posted some of the student regulations. I mean, a student could make an innocent comment that might offend somebody in authority, and they're dismissed.
Correct. There's no due process. There was no hearing. They were suspended indefinitely, which was expulsion. And that happened again and again. Sometimes it may have been justified, but in many, many cases, it was not a very authoritarian regime. And they tried and tried to make these students conform to these long lists of regulations, keeping in mind that many of these students in the early years were primary and secondary students.
Now, this is a little bit earlier in the 20th century, but you list some of the regulations for students. Each student is required to have a Bible in the chapel hymnal. All students, whether campus or town boarders, found lounging about restaurant stores or questionable places will be disciplined by the president, and for the second offense, suspended. No young woman is permitted to leave the grounds unless accompanied by the matron or a lady teacher. Now, that would not have been so peculiar to SC State. That would have been true with any young woman in the early 20th century. The use of intoxicating drinks or tobacco is forbidden. Dice playing, card playing, checker playing. All students must be in bed with lights extinguished by 10:30 p.m. Every student over 15 years of age must do 2 hours manual labor per week under the direction of the president of the college. Now, how long did something like that stay in effect, that students had to do labor for the college?
It prevailed into the 1920s. They were paid small sums of money, but they were required to work on the farm, to work on the campus.
That reminds me of Benjamin May's story. He cleaned out outhouses, privies, because the money was good.
Right. He had gotten a job in the early portion of the second decade of the 20th century, 1912, 1913, and along there doing just that. The campus did not have a full-fledged running water and sewer system yet. Part of it was, nor did they have electricity provided to the entire campus yet. So, yes, Benny Mays came and cleaned outhouses after everyone else went to bed.
Well, the Turner administration is also coincides. He's very authoritarian as an individual. I think that's fair. It's also the beginning of the civil rights era, and students are beginning to be more active, and this leads to conflict and confrontation on campus. There are student walkouts, for example, boycotts of the dining hall.
Well, students had been, in many instances, dissatisfied with the arrangements they found on campus, with the autocratic atmosphere. There were some early student rebellions, protests in the 19-teens and 20s. There's not very much information on them, regrettably. But by the 1950s, students were joining in the civil rights movement as it began and then gained momentum. And this occurred in Orangeburg when black parents signed a petition to desegregate the public schools following the Brown decision and the With All Deliberate Speed decision in 1955. And got themselves in hot water with the president of South Carolina State, Benard Turner, who did not want them getting involved in these community activities, especially civil rights that would threaten the institution. So you had a boycott of classes in April of 1956. You had students suspended. Fred Moore, the Student Government Association president, was expelled within a few weeks of graduation. So it was a tumultuous period with students rising up and attempting to assert themselves for rights they believed that they deserved both on the campus and off the campus. And that would continue beyond the 1950s and on into the 1960s, where you had waves or generations of students protesting in Orangeburg for civil rights in the community, for an end to Jim Crow, and then turning on the president yet again, Benard C. Turner, and protesting against the authoritarian atmosphere that existed on campus with the so-called cause in 1967, led by Ike Williams and many other students, where there was once again a boycott of classes, a strike. And they managed to get that resolved. But with the intervention of Governor McNair, Benard Turner's tenure as president came to a not-so-glorious end in 1967, the summer of 1967.
Governor McNair had done something people wouldn't have thought of in those days. He asked student leaders to meet with him, Ike Williams and others.
He did. Initially, when the students began protesting against Turner in March of 1967, and ironically, one of the causes of the protest was that Turner had dismissed two of the first white faculty members on the campus. But then that issue exploded into a whole range of issues. And students threatened to go on strike and then did go on strike. And Governor McNair's initial response was complete lack of sympathy with the students and support for Turner, as was the case with most older people, older black and white people. What is wrong with these students? Why are they not going to class? McNair, to his credit, did agree to meet with them. And he sat down and listened and decided that the students did have some very legitimate complaints there in the spring of 1967. And he intervened to see that students who had been suspended would be returned to class, assuming their lawsuit was settled amicably. And he agreed to begin to end some of these rigorous rules and regulations and agreed that he would deal with the president. He wouldn't promise the students that he would terminate him, but he said, let me work on that. And he did, and he called President Turner in after the semester was over and told President Turner it was time to retire.
Then we come with almost a generational change with Maceo Nance becoming the new president of South Carolina State.
Absolutely. It's almost as if, as I pointed out, the institution had been founded again between the spring semester of 67 and the fall semester. Maceo Nance deserves a good deal of credit, but so do students at that time who pushed for and agitated for change, faculty members as well. They created a faculty senate then once President Nance took over, student organizations. The NAACP was allowed on the campus.
Okay, now wait a minute. Before this, President Turner had forbid the NAACP from coming onto a black campus?
President Turner did not get along with NAACP leaders here in South Carolina at all. He certainly didn't get along with Ida Quincy Newman and Billy Fleming and James Hinton and many of the others. But also bear in mind that the state of South Carolina had outlawed membership by state employees and public school teachers in the NAACP. That legislation had been passed in 1956, so faculty members were not permitted to belong to the NAACP, and students could not form a youth branch on the campus. But many of them, like Ike Williams, had been active in the NAACP in high school. Ike Williams came from Bonds Wilson High School in Charleston, so they carried that with them when they came to state. But Turner was not enamored with the NAACP at all, and they detested him.
In your evaluation of Turner, we do have to move on. I wish we had another hour. He never was accepted by the black middle class in South Carolina, the group that was very influential, whether it's NAACP or sororities, fraternities. He was something of an outsider.
He was an outsider. Benner C. Turner was an introvert in almost every sense of that word. T.J. Crawford, the late T.J. Crawford, told me that Turner's idea of an enjoyable evening was to go home and pull the curtains shut and sit down with a good book. He did not like to socialize, even informally, and he didn't. And he didn't like to rub elbows with students. He was nervous. He was ill at ease around students and faculty members and other people as well. He was a very smart man, very brilliant man, a man of impeccable honesty, but he had difficulty in social situations. And so he never got to know people. After he arrived to become the dean of the new law school in 1947, never reached out. People found him aloof, cold, and autocratic, and that didn't set well.
We get to this change in 1967 and at least officially the end of the Jim Crow era. So how about putting a coda on this story about South Carolina State as you do with your conclusion?
Well, South Carolina State under President Nance goes through a transition here as it moves away from what had been its strictly black heritage and becomes a more inclusive institution. There are white students. There are increasing number of students from the Caribbean. Not large numbers, certainly not large numbers of white students. There are increasingly large numbers of Asian and white faculty members and administrators in the 1970s, 1980s, 90s, and into the 21st century. So the school makes a transition in that sense, but it also tries to maintain and does maintain its heritage as a historically black institution. And so it's found a difficult road to trod down in the years before segregation ended and now in the years since formal legalized segregation has ended. It's been difficult. It's been difficult financially. It's been difficult in terms of leadership. There's been a turnover in leadership in the last couple of decades or more, as far as the presidencies have been concerned, as far as membership on the Board of Trustees has been concerned. And this has not helped the institution as it's tried to navigate its way out of the 20th century and now well into the 21st century.
When did you first come to State College as a faculty member?
I arrived in August of 1967. Somewhat ironically, the very first person, it was strictly coincidence, I met on the campus was Maceo Nance, who had just been named interim president.
You have lived through the last 40 years of State College's
right.
history.
50 years as of August of 2017. Yes, it's been a long, in some cases tumultuous, but in many other cases, very, very rewarding time.
Well, Dr. Bill Hine, author of South Carolina State University, A Black Land-Grant College in Jim Crow America, thanks so much for being with us today on The Journal. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. Bill Hine's book about South Carolina State really opens a window for a lot of folks into the world of African Americans in South Carolina from 1896 to the 21st century. It's a world that may not be familiar to many folks, be they black or white. It's not just the sources, and he did incredible research, but it's the way it's presented and the illustrations in this book, most of which have never been published before, are a window into the world of black South Carolina and all of our history. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.